Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsum a day for the 8th of Tammuz. Today's responsum is going to be Rav Moshe Feinstein, who is discussing an educator who claimed, apparently with some truth, to have financial claims both on the school that had let him go or asked him to leave, and the school that he eventually found a job with. This is from Igrot Moshe in the first chelek of Choshen Mishpat, in the first part where he talks about Choshen Mishpat issues of monetary laws, and Siman Lamed Zayin, responsum number 37, and it is dated the 8th of Tammuz of Tufshin Chav Gimel of 1963. The story was that he's writing to Rav Nota Tzvi Greenblatt, who was a student of his, and he says he doesn't know the case exactly, but so he's going to answer it for every possible case. It sounds like when the teacher left the community he was in, and this whole responsum is a reminder. And I think it's better now, but I don't know that it's completely better now. I've seen situations where educators have been let go who don't have financial means to easily find their way to a new job. So here was an educator, a teacher, who had been let go and from one place, and there was a certain fight about it, there were certain issues, and he went to find a job in another place, and he claims that the principal or the administrator of the old school, the school where he had first been employed, had said to him that they would pay his moving expenses in order that he would sign away his rights to going, taking them to a Beit Din. In other words, they were worried he would take them to Beit Din. He thought he would take them to Beit Din. And they said, or he claims that they said, that the administrator said, we'll pay your moving costs and therefore you won't take us to Beit Din. The claim from the other side was that whatever had been said, and there was some debate about that as well, but whatever had been said, there had never been a kinyan. They had never formalized the agreement. But Rav Moshe says that shouldn't really matter since he's moved, meaning by this time he's already moved to the new place and we're going to find out that he's actually doing well in the new place, which is nice for him. But since he's already moved and he's already not taken them to Beit Din, so he's foregone those rights. Rav Moshe says that when two people make an agreement and one side fulfills his obligations in the agreement is made, and it doesn't matter if there was a kinyan or not. So, therefore, here, there was no need for a kinyan for some formalization of the thing. They had made an agreement. He acted on the agreement that he made, and therefore, he needs to be paid as if they had formalized the agreement. Whether there was an agreement or not, I think we'll get to in a minute, or in a few minutes, but no need to formalize it. The reason why you sometimes think you need to formalize it is that there are cases in the Gemara where if somebody says, I'll pay you a lot of money to do X, the person can, after the fact, say, no, I didn't mean it. I was being mishatebecha. I was tricking you. I was fooling you. And the example in the Gemara is an example of chalitza. Let's say, sadly, a man passed away without children. His wife is required to either marry a brother or to do chalitza. Nowadays, we only do chalitza. So chalitza would be the ceremony where the brother performs a ceremony with her that frees her to marry other people. Let's suppose that brother, for wrong reasons, is not willing to do the chalitza. I just recently heard of a case where the man was not religious anymore, and therefore, why should I bother doing chalitza, this stupid ceremony? So there's a whole question about that. But one of the strategies the Gemara allows is offering him lots of money and then after the fact not paying off the money. So Rav Moshe says that's not a general permissibility thing that you can claim, oh, it was a negotiating tactic, I was fooling you, and since you didn't formalize it in writing or in a kinyan, an act of acquisition to make sure that it was an absolute obligation, I don't have to do it. We're not allowed to do that. Chalitza, Rav Moshe says, is an exception because the brother has the obligation to do chalitza. I mean, it's not a right of the brother to do chalitza. It's an obligation of the brother to do chalitza, and there's no monetary value attached to it. It's something he's required to do for nothing. So therefore, the Gemara allows for tricking him into doing what he was needed to do anyway. But in this situation, even if the administrator is sure that this teacher could not have won a din Torah, could not have won a case in court, and therefore we could say, well, I'm not taking away anything from him by tricking him into moving without suing us, it's not true. He, the teacher, has the right to sue them in court, in Beit Din, to take them to Beit Din over this issue, and let the Beit Din decide what it is. So therefore, since it's a right of his, and it's a right that people do tend to sell, meaning people are willing to compromise them, people are willing to take less in order to be certain of getting something. So even though And they're willing to do it, Rav Moshe says, even when they're sure they'll win. That's also true, right? People settle cases that they're very confident of winning because it's easier or because it saves the time and the trouble of going through the Beit Din process, and therefore they'd rather have the money now, right? If I'm sure that I will win $100,000 in a Din Torah, but it'll take us 5 years to get to it, and you say to me, listen, I can save you the time and the trouble and the stress, and I'll give you $20,000 now, there are people who will accept whatever the numbers are, there are people who accept that deal. So Moshe Feinstein says the same thing here. Since this is something that he did have a right to, and it's the kind of, it is an economic good, meaning the right to take somebody else to Din Torah is an economic good in the sense that people will pay to not be taken to Din Torah, and people will pay, and people will accept payment to forego that right. So then if the administrator had actually promised him moving expenses, that's an actual promise. And it's not one which you can say after the fact, no, I didn't really mean it, I was just saying it to negotiate in that way. That's not the way negotiations work. One could have said, though, that the obligation doesn't get formalized until there's an act of formalizing of some sort, writing it down, doing a kinyan, you know, like lifting a handkerchief or something like that. But there, Rav Moshe is saying it's not true. That's only true when it hasn't been done yet. But in the situation where the other party has fulfilled their obligation by this agreement, and the person didn't say, no, wait, I didn't mean it, so then there's no kinyan, there's no need for a kinyan, and therefore it's been formalized, and whatever agreement was made has come into play, and therefore whatever the community or whatever the school or whatever the administration of the school had in fact promised this man, they would have to fulfill and they would have to come through on. Now comes the question of what was it that was actually said to the man. If the administrator, if the menahel, the principal, the administrator had said of his own volition that the teacher shouldn't cause problems and shouldn't take them to court because the lay leadership of the school have said that they will give him his moving expenses, and then it turns out that the balabatim, the leadership, in fact didn't say it, the administrator was lying. It's a very sad thing, but unfortunately it happens even in Jewish schools, and it's really a terrible thing. It's a terrible situation. It happens more than we would like to think, and it's terrible that it happens. We should notice it and be bothered by it and complain about it, and I think this is me talking about emotion, but I think we should really protest it. We should really make an issue of it when we see people lying. I think that's true in general. It should certainly be true in Jewish communal service positions. When we see people like that lying, we need to call them to account for that and to make clear that that's not acceptable to us. So in this case, if it were to turn out, and it's going to be bad now, because if it were to turn out that the administrator was lying, the leadership did not in fact commit to that, and he was lying, so he didn't say that he would give it, and he didn't commit himself to it, so what he's caused this teacher now is damage, but he's caused it what's called dinda de garmi. His lie led to this teacher to leave without taking them to Beit Din, and it turns out that it's a dinda de garmi. Now, in general, dinda de garmi, when people cause damage in that way, we tend to paskin that they're liable for it, but here the problem is that once he lied to him, and you'd need that the hesek will be clear, the damage will be obvious, meaning if somebody is going to take a coin as part of a sale, and in those times you weren't sure which coins were valid, which coins weren't valid, which coins had the right amount of metal in them and which didn't, and then you take them to a money changer. So somebody lies to somebody else and says, well, I took it to the money changer and it's a fine coin, and it turns out to be worthless. We know what the cost is. The cost is the value of that coin. So in those cases, you can require the person who caused the damage, the person who is liable because of the rules of Garmi, we can make him liable for that. That's only when we know how much it is, right? But here, even if he took them to court, there's no amount that he would have had to take in, and that we know the amount that he was claiming. He was claiming the moving costs. But we can't say it's Bari Hazeka. We can't say it's certain that the administrator cost him that, because he can't be sure what the Beit Din would have agreed to and would have said, because maybe the lay leadership would have found some claim in court that would have led the court to say no. In fact, they weren't obligated, whatever it would have been. And even if, and remember that Rav Moshe is being very clear that he's answering this in theory because he hasn't heard all the right claims, he hasn't heard both sides, he doesn't know everything about the case, so he's just answering at least in theoretical terms. So maybe the Balabati, maybe the lay leadership have some real claims, and the court would look at it, and the Beit Din would look at it and say, in fact, no, this teacher didn't have the right to the moving costs. Even if we would say, well, most courts, most Batei Din, find ways to compromise, as they're ideally supposed to, because, and this is not Rav Moshe speaking, this is again me throwing something in here, but I think Rav Moshe would have agreed, I think it's clear, but we prefer pshara, we prefer compromises, because we prefer situations where each side gets something, because when we take a case, through to its full conclusion, one side wins and one side loses. The side that loses is certainly not happy, and the side that wins is happy this time, but they won't be happy the next time when they're the ones who lose. So we generally look for pshara. So you might have said, well, if his moving costs were $1,000, we can be sure the Beit Din would have created some kind of a pshara, and it's likely he would have gotten at least $200, and therefore we should be able to claim that this menahel, this administrator, has cost this man at least $200. You'd have to pay the $200. But he can't do that because that's not the same thing as causing damage. Since it will have been a pshara thing, it will have been a compromise, it will have been for the purpose of settling everything between them, but without a claim of actual rights and value, that would not be the fact that this person, that this menahel may have caused this man to lose that. That would not, Rav Moshe says, rise to the level of damage that we can charge the menahel. But, he says, it might be different here, you can claim, because people don't want other people generally to have complaints against them. So it could be that you could say that we're fairly certain that the lay leadership would have given something, whatever it is, in order that everything, and it's an interesting comment about lay leaderships then, and we can think about whether it's true of lay leaderships now, but just to be sure that this man doesn't walk around with complaints about them and the way they treated him, that maybe they would have given him something, and therefore you could say maybe in that sense it could be considered bari hezeka, it could be considered a fairly certain level of damage, and that maybe the menahel, maybe the administrator, should be considered liable for that by virtue of the fact that he tricked this man out of that. In this case, complicating the case, is that the administrator denies that he said that. He claims that all he said was that he would speak to the Baal HaBatim about it, and he would have the Baal HaBatim, the lay leadership, consider the question, and that's what happened. That he brought the issue to the Baal HaBatim, to the lay leadership, and they decided that they weren't going to give it. So then you might have thought that the menahel is liable for an oath to swear that that's not true, but you don't, because there's no money involved here, because even if it turned out that he wasn't telling the truth on that, it wouldn't yet be rise to the level where you'd have to actually pay money. So all that is the first side of the case. The first side of the case was the teacher claims that they promised reimbursement costs, and then the question is, and that they promised it in return for him not bringing them to Beit Din. He did his part, and now he claims that they're not doing their part. So if it was in fact true that he was promised that way, and then they have to pay it. But the menahel claims that he never promised him. So if the menahel lied and promised it to him, and there had never been a commitment that way, then the question is whether the administrator himself becomes liable for it. There, Rav Moshe felt that while it is true that he has caused the damage, it's not a certain enough form of damage that you can have the menahel pay for it, you can require the menahel pay for it. More than that, the administrator claims he never said that they would pay. He only said that they would consider it, and then it gets even more complicated than that because they, in fact, considered it, and therefore he thinks he doesn't have to pay. So that's one side of the question that, depending on the actual facts, ends up being where things would stand. Rav Nota Greenblatt had suggested in the Rav Moshe point says that another claim, perhaps, why the original school wouldn't have to pay him is that when the man got to the new place, it turned out to be a much better fit. Important to remember, I know this, I've seen this happen, right? There are people who can seem like terrible teachers and completely unsuccessful, and there's no way they could ever succeed. And they get to another environment, another school, another way of handling students, and they turn out to be excellent teachers. They turn out to be well-respected and well-admired and really a benefit to their community. Important to remember, this is true in other contexts as well. There are other situations where the Gemara talks about that, but here's one good one where it's worth remembering that when we see somebody, if we find them to be unsuccessful and not working out, that is sometimes a question of their talents, but often also it's a question of fit, a question of the environment in which they're working, and there might be, if we shift things around for them in their lives, they can find much more success. That would be relevant here because Rav Nota Greenblatt says, so maybe you could argue that the old school doesn't have to pay because this going to the new school ended up being a net gain, a very large net gain for this teacher. So it turns out there was no hezek, there was no damage involved because he made back the moving costs and more, and the fact that he now has a steady job that's paying him well, for all I know it could have been paying him more than the old place, and therefore the lie didn't cost him anything. Rav Moshe says that's not the way we figure out these things in terms of damages, meaning that when one person damages another, the fact that sometime later on that damage turns out to create a much greater benefit doesn't matter. If at the moment that it happens, it was a damage, Rav Moshe says that's the way we figure it, even though later on it would come out to be something much more valuable. So even though there is a case in the Gemara in Bava Kamma about, this is a case about oxen that gore each other, and the question is, let's say at the moment that one gored the ox, it damaged it 50 zoos, and then later on the price went up and was worth 400 zoos, and there's a whole bright discussion there that the mazik can't say that I didn't cost you anything because it's now gone up in value, because the person who was damaged can say, well, had you not done this, it might have gone up even more in value. But the sma says that that's perhaps only talking about that it's about a nevela, that it's talking about where the animal was killed, and therefore you can that in a case of nevela, sma said, where it wouldn't be relevant to say such a thing, that without the negicha it would be a keren yoter, because it's the value of the carcass that has risen in value, not of the live ox. So that would be the whole situation. So Rav Moshe is saying that would lead us to understand that that's a special situation there, having to do with the way that you divide up the damages, because there the mazik has the right to some of the profits as part of having been the mazik, as being the damager who becomes liable for the whole thing. So he can't profit off of it, but he, in terms of him not being liable for things, if it goes up in value, he can, in certain situations, allow himself not to have to pay that. But when it comes to a person or any other kind of damages where there's not this halacha of chatziyah shavach, that he gets half the uptick in value, if there is an uptick in value, then this halacha doesn't come into play. And therefore, Moshe says, when it comes to damages, even if after the fact the person becomes much more valuable, it won't matter, because the moment of the damage was the damage. I don't know if this is a great example, but it's one that came to my mind, so let me share it. Let's suppose somebody is a professional athlete of some sort, and somebody else damages them in a way that ends their professional career, and they end up being much more successful as a broadcaster, and they end up making much, much more money. So Moshe is saying, you can't say, well, I'm not liable for having ended your professional career, which had X value, by virtue of the fact that you ended up later on making more money, because that's not relevant to the time of the damage. And the way we figure out damages is the time of the damage. And it may be true that buried within that damage is some greater profit, but that's not in the rights of the mazik, of the person causing the damage, to say. So bringing back to our case of the educator, the fact that he later on found a much better job, that paid him much more money and had much more career advancement, that would not change the fact that if the lay leadership had in fact promised to pay his moving expenses, they're required to pay his moving expenses. And it would also not mean that if the administrator lied about it and caused him to lose his right to sue and to take them to Beit Din because of it, none of that would be relevant to the later situation. It's related to an idea you have in the Gemara, what's called Mishmaya Rechimu Alei, that from heaven they took compassion, they had compassion on this person, and therefore they gave him an extra value. So Rav Moshe is saying, so let's say they lied to him, or they said they would give it to him, and now they don't want to go back, and they want to go back, and they want to say, well, you don't need it because you made so much more money by moving, so the move was good for you, so we shouldn't have to pay you. So the example that Rav Moshe gives is a Gemara in Bava Kamma on Daf Kuf Tet Zayin 116, that says, let's say two people's objects are being lost in the water. They've broken off of a ship and they've fallen in the water, and they're both being carried away by the current. And one person is much more valuable than the other person. So the person says, please help me, please save my whatever it is. And so the second person says, I will, as long as you pay me back my object that's about to be destroyed. So let's say one has a barrel of pasta. I don't know if you keep pasta in barrels. So that was a bad example. A barrel of a very cheap wine. And the other one has a barrel of very expensive wine, or of honey, something that's really much more expensive. So the cheap barrel is worth like $10, and the expensive barrel is worth $1,000. Man says, help me save my $1,000 barrel. He says, fine, but you're going to have to pay me the $10 for the barrel that I'm giving up on in order to go save you. And they agree. Then, fluke of nature, however it happens, right? This is where Mishamaya Rechimu Alei, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had rachim on this person. The barrel, his barrel, the cheap barrel, washes up on shore anyway. So he goes, he saves the $1,000 barrel, and the cheap barrel, the $10 barrel, washes up shore anyway. The man whose $1,000 barrel was now saved would say, well, I don't need to pay you for it. You told me you wanted me to pay you for it because it was going to be lost, but now it's not lost. So the Gemara says that's not true. Since the agreement was he would pay for it, it's mishamayim rechim olei, they gave him something from Shamayim, and therefore it's his, and he should get the payment as well. Here too, right? Here too, where they are going to say, well, you know, we only said this to you because we thought it was a loss for you that you had to move, and we thought you were going to never get this money back, but it turned out you got this money back and more and a much better job. They don't have the ability to say that because the agreement is at the moment that it's made, and therefore they can't then look at later events and say, nope, you see what happened, we don't have to worry about that. Turns out, though, because the case is where the claim is, his claim was that the Balabatim promised it, the leadership promised it, the administrator claims that it wasn't true, that he only promised to have them consider it, and they considered it. And the administrator claims that it was by virtue of that he told him to move and forego a case in Beit Din. So theoretically, the administrator should really be on the hook for something, but he's sort of a mazik of garmi. He caused damage rather than actually performing damage, right? He didn't take a sledgehammer and break objects of somebody else's. He caused him damage by the words that he used, by giving him this advice or making this agreement with him. This man, therefore, didn't go to Beit Din, and therefore you'd think that there's some definite damage because we know the courts tend to make compromises between people. But since we don't know what that is, and we need Bari Hazeka in the cases of Garmi, we need the definition of the damage very clear. And Rav Moshe thinks that he can't really obligate this minahel, this administrator, anything. Okay, so he doesn't go on from there, and so I won't as well. It seems to me there's a little bit more to say about that case and the minahel's, the administrator's obligations in that situation, but we'll leave it right there. Meaning our obligations in terms of halacha, that Rav Moshe has covered, but in terms of when things go wrong, in the same way the court would have striven for pshara, I could easily imagine that we would recommend to this minahel, to this administrator, that he find a pshara as well, but we'll leave that for another time. What about the new place? Let's suppose, because this teacher claims that the new place also promised him to pay his moving costs. Apparently, his moving costs loomed very large for him, and I think that is probably a reflection of the salaries of teachers at the time and of the financial situation of the teachers at the time. So even though the new situation is working out well, I think that it seems like the moving costs are still a financial hole that he would like to get out of. And he claims that the new place also said that they would reimburse him. So if they agree to it, then Rav Moshe says again, the same way as before, even if there was no formal agreement, and like with a kinyan, an act of acquisition to formalize the agreement, since it was part of the rental agreement, meaning he's hiring himself out to them, they agreed on a salary, they agreed on benefits, he's claiming they agreed on moving costs. But that would only be if the administrator of the new place said it in the context of agreeing on what his salary would be, right? We'll pay you $20,000 a year plus your moving costs, or $20,000 in your first year plus your moving costs. So if that's true, then that'll be true. But if they agreed about the salary, and then afterwards, in a separate conversation, in some way separated conversation, the teacher had said, I also need my moving costs, and the administrator had said, he'll speak to the Balabatim, he'll speak to the leadership, and he promised, and then they promised it. So that would need a kinyan, that would need a formal act of acquisition, because he has never gone back on the agreement, and therefore what they agreed with him was that he would move there, and he would start teaching, and they would pay him this on the teaching. And then there was a separate question of, they said, we'll pay the moving costs, and he never said, well, I'm not going to become a teacher unless you pay my moving costs. He just asked for it. So even if they agreed, that's the kind of thing you're going to need a formal act of acquisition to formalize the agreement, because there's nothing else formalizing it. Meaning in the first case, where it's part of the original agreement to teach, his having moved there and started teaching makes the agreement fully active, and therefore, since moving costs was part of the agreement, they're now obligated for it and liable for it. But where it's a separate agreement, so there's nothing to formalize and to say, yes, this is a full-fledged agreement, we've agreed, it's settled, we've decided, therefore you would have needed an active acquisition of some sort in terms of in order to make that fully obligatory upon them, because it's more like a gift that's separate from the salary than it is like the salary. That, by the way, is true. The Ramah says, in terms of somebody who says he was going to give a gift to somebody else after a certain period of time, and even though he makes an arev, he makes a guarantor of that, all of that, the Ramah says, will only be when they made some formal agreement and there was a kinyan, there was an act of acquisition to formalize it. And then once again, there's the question of whether the Menahel, the administrator, had said he would be liable or responsible for all this, and he denies it, and then you might want to obligate him to take an oath. And then, I must have noticed this before, but I didn't say it before, so I should say it now. And then it turns out the success that this man had was in the new city was not the first job he took in the new city. It was like the second job in the new city. So he's got moving costs coming from the people he left that he wanted and the people that he went to originally, who then it ended up not working out, had promised him moving costs. And that's where it's all coming into play. And he's saying that. And then again, Rav Notz Greenblatt had suggested that maybe the fact that he eventually succeeded means that they should be off the hook for the moving costs. But Rav Moshe says that's not true, and you have all these situations. So, in this situation that was unclear to Rav Moshe, but that he covered anyway for the Eifer Tammuz, you have the situation of the commitments we make to each other and when they're formalized and when they're not, and the kinds of obligations we have in those situations. We have that if people make a commitment to somebody else in return for them foregoing some right of theirs, then as soon as they forego that right, that becomes obligatory. That agreements, in other words, become formalized either by signing of a contract or performing an act of acquisition, or Rav Moshe is saying they become formalized by one side fulfilling its obligation, the other side can no longer back out because then it's already been a formalized agreement. Then there's the question of when two people disagree about what was said, and one person says he only committed to X. Well, if a person lied, that can be damage. And if you cause damage to people by lying, and it's clear the damage that was caused, the person who caused the damage by lying, that would be Garmi. And Rav Moshe says that that would obligate the Menahel, the administrator, because he lied about it. He claims he didn't lie about it. Then, if the amount of money that was clearly would be obligated was clear and well-defined, that's what's called Bari Hazeka. And then, if he denies it, he would be obligated a Shavua, an oath, to say that that's not what he said, and therefore he's not obligated. And that would be the situation that you have in terms of this teacher, in terms of other people who find themselves in a situation where commitments made to them, they feel, weren't being lived up. That is our response of the day for the 8th of Tammuz, Rav Moshe Feinstein, on a false promise to reimburse moving costs. Have a great day.